Good afternoon. I call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Monday, January 25th, 2016. We're here in the Capitol Building. Let the record reflect that the time is 3:45 p.m. Committee members present today, Vice Chair Senator Costello, Senator Machicki, Senator Coghill, and myself, Chair Senator Giesel. I believe other committee members will be joining us shortly. Thank you to Ann Kreckelberg, who will be our recording secretary again this year. Thank you so much, Ann. And helping us today on the audio is Cody Grusendorf. Thanks very much, Cody, for your help. So today, our first meeting of Senate Resources, we're going to be talking about the AK LNG project and getting our update, regular quarterly update. And so I'm very pleased that Mr. Steve Butt could join us again today and apprise us of how we're doing on our goal of getting gas for Alaskans. Welcome.
Thank you, Senator Giesel. I appreciate the chance to be here.
Move that microphone.
Can you hear me okay? Okay. I appreciate the chance to be here. For the record, my name is Steve Butt. I work as the Senior Project Manager for the Alaska LNG Project. I'm here to provide an update, as you said, under our triannual obligation from SB 138 to start out 2016, talk a little bit about what's happened since we last got together in Palmer in early September of 2015, share a little bit of our progress, plans for 2016, and some of the things we've accomplished. As always, I try to represent the team I work with. We have a lot of really good people, about 130 of them, with hundreds of years of experience between them, who are experts in what they do. And so when I'm presenting the work, I'm really presenting their work. So I'm here speaking on behalf of our team. But I want to take a second to talk about, you know, that's the voice I'm trying to speak with. But I'd like you guys to kind of listen as representatives of the owners of the project. You know, you represent the state of Alaska, who has a 25% stake in the project. And we'll talk a little bit more about that. But kind of the board of directors for one of the participants for the four parties that are still working the project under the joint venture agreement for pre-feed. So I'll try to talk a lot about ownership and what that might mean and how to think about the project in the context of selling gas and how does one create a successful project that can sell gas competitively in a global marketplace and try really to connect with what do Alaskans as owners of the project need to learn about the project, because we are spending money that the state is covering 25% of the cost. So we want you as representatives of those owners, as the board of directors, if you will, to feel confident that you're getting enough information about that spend and that the project's on track and that we understand the risks going forward and that the decisions that get made make sense. So I'll try to be talking on behalf of the team to you as the owners.
So Steve, that raises kind of an overarching question that I hope you'll address as we go along, and that is, in this low-price environment, does a project of this size still make sense? Because as you say, we are the board of directors, and our constituents are actually asking that question of us these days. Why are we spending so much on a project that they don't see as possibly ever being economic? So as you go through that, if you would just kind of help us answer that question.
Sure.
Thanks.
Senator, I'd be happy to provide information to help folks get to that answer. I mean, I think the key is for individuals to get to the place where they can make that decision for themselves. Mm-hmm. And so it's incumbent on the project and the owners to find ways to share that information so that people can understand the issues and come to that decision for themselves. So I'd be happy to talk about that. Almost everything I'm going to talk about will address some element of that decision process. So I look forward to talking about it, and as always, I really welcome questions as we go to make sure that this is as much of a conversation as possible and as little of a monologue as possible.
Good, and I do want to welcome Senator Stoltz to the committee.
For the other two senators, I couldn't find them.
Thank you for doing that. Go ahead, Steve.
So with that kind of background, I wanted to always take a minute for folks who may be new to the project, and you know, you guys will have to give me a little bit of forgiveness because I know you all know the project really well, but I know some of the folks maybe listening in or learning about the project for the first time may not really understand what the project is, so if you could just bear with me for a minute, I'll try and give a quick overview of the project. When we talk about Alaska LNG, we're talking about an integrated project to liquefy natural gas and contact or connect the resource on Alaska's North Slope to Asian buyers. That's the heart of the project. And that concept is very different than previous concepts. So, you know, to the core question of does the project make sense in a low oil price environment, one could say, does it make sense in any oil price environment? Does it make sense? And what we've tried to do is create a structure where, for the first time ever, the four parties who have a claim on the resource on the North Slope, the three producers who purchased the right to produce the hydrocarbon, and the state who has a derivative right to its share of the income through royalty, taxes, and other mechanisms, to work together. And the state takes its share through an equity position in the project, which was worked out under SB 138 as 25% of the project, so that the state is an owner. The state has a seat at the table, which is why we preamble this conversation with, this is a discussion with the board of directors for the owner. So this is the first time you've ever had all four of those parties work together. So the first piece of your answer is, that's never happened before. So while I respect skepticism, and I know that folks have seen gas projects in Alaska start and stop many times, and they kind of think that's what they do, they start and then they stop, and this one has yet to stop, they're wondering if that might happen. And in today's environment, it feels even more, you know, problematic, because everybody's tight on cash. All the participants are. That's not unique to any one of the four parties. So what we have to do as a project is figure out, what are we doing to minimize today's spend and reduce our long-term cost of supply so that we can be competitive? Can we spend just the right amount of money today to do the right work, to keep the option of doing the project open at a low enough cost that the project can be competitive? And I will come back to that theme probably more times than anyone would like. And if I don't come back to it at least 20 times, I probably haven't done it justice. So it's all about competitive cost of supply. But as a project, to connect the resource to the market at the right cost, we have to do some things here in Alaska. First, we have to connect Point Thompson to Prudhoe Bay, and the Point Thompson resource owners will carry the cost of that interconnect line because it's tied to the resources from Point Thompson coming into the AKLNG project, where we have to build a gas treatment plant. Now, that's really important. I think the three most important letters on this page are CO2, which is what we must do for the project, which is shorthand. It's chemical shorthand for carbon dioxide, and I'll talk a little bit more about that. But if I could highlight anything on this page, it's the importance of having a gas treatment plant remove all the CO2. We'll come back to that. And then we have to build the pipeline to move the gas from the north to the south so that we have the access to ports where we can deliver LNG to markets 12 months out of the year, which has already been demonstrated by the existing ConocoPhillips facility, and then build the liquefaction facility. So there's three core activities the Alaska LNG project has to complete. First, it has to treat the gas, then it has to transport the gas, then we liquefy the gas. To treat the gas, we have to build a gas treatment facility, which is about 25% of the cost of the project, to remove somewhere on the order of 450 million cubic feet a day of CO2. That's an enormous number. To put it into context, it's well over 4 trillion cubic feet of CO2 over the life of the project. In all of the state of Alaska, on average, over the entire year, Alaskans burn about 220 million cubic feet of gas. That's everybody in Alaska for all the gas used everywhere, which means it's only half as much as the CO2 alone that we have to treat for this project and put back into Prudhoe Bay. And that's because Prudhoe Bay has about 12% CO2 in the reservoir. Mother Nature made a giant reservoir that the Prudhoe Bay operator's done a great job of managing over the years by re-injecting the gas. They produce 7 to 9 billion cubic feet of gas every day for the last 30 years. They put that gas back in the ground. They've taken it all out and put it all back in almost four times. They know where the gas is. That's an important advantage. But in doing so, they have demonstrated the composition has about 12% CO2. There are no LNG projects in the world handling that much CO2. Now, Point Thompson has about 4% CO2, which is an advantage. By bringing the two resources together, the gas treatment facility we have to build to handle Prudhoe Bay gas is about the same size if we did it all by itself or in combination. And that may sound a little bit strange, but if you think about some of the numbers, it may make a little bit more sense. About three-quarters of the gas is from Prudhoe Bay. That's about 23, 24 trillion cubic feet of gas. And about 6 to 8 trillion cubic feet of gas is at Point Thompson. It only has 4% CO2. So if you blend the two together, you only have to handle about 10% in the stream. Whereas if you did Prudhoe Bay all by itself, you'd have to do 12%. So the gas treatment facility that we have to build for Prudhoe Bay all by itself or to handle both is about the same. Now, that's a big advantage because we just blended more gas and treated more gas and put the CO2 back in the ground, and we didn't have to build another gas treatment plant. That's a benefit of having all the four parties work together and trying to have a large integrated project. And it's also a really critical element of this project because, as I said, you have to spend 25% of the cost of the project or somewhere on the order of $8 to $10 billion to treat the gas before you even put it in the pipeline. Once you have the gas treated and all the impurities removed and put back in the ground in Prudhoe Bay where they came from, you then build a pipeline, which is another 25% of the project. It's about 804 miles, and it allows us to transport gas from the north to the south. It allows us to provide gas to Alaskans. We'll be working with Alaska Gas Line Development Corporation, or AGDC, on the interconnection points under SB 138. There's about five, but we can resolve that number and work that out. And then we have to liquefy the gas. And as, again, for the folks who may not remember this, we have to get the gas very cold. It's about minus 260 degrees Fahrenheit, which is extremely cold. You know, we're talking the kind of cold temperatures in the dark parts of space. And at those temperatures, methane converts from a gaseous form, like air in this room, to a liquid form. And in doing so, it shrinks by a factor of 600. And the reason we do that is it's much easier to move one boat of cold, liquefied gas to a buyer than 600 boats of ambient gas in a vapor phase to a buyer. So half the cost of the project is the marine facilities and the liquefaction facilities to allow us to connect the resource in the north to the buyers in what is conceivably Asian markets. But it really connects it to anywhere in the world. Once you put the LNG on the water, it can go anywhere. So conceptually, we think about providing gas to Asia because that's the forecast where the demand for LNG is growing, but it doesn't have to be there. It allows you to access any market for LNG. Now, that's what this project is all about, treating gas, transporting gas, liquefying gas, so that you can connect the vast resource on the North Slope to markets that need it. To put that into further context, Alaskans use about 220 million cubic feet of gas, as I said. This facility will ship about 2.4 billion cubic feet of gas a day, which means 10 times as much as the state of Alaska uses will be shipped for export purposes to Asian markets. And in doing so, you underpin the project by having buyers interested in getting the product. That's enough gas to source a country the size of Germany. It's a tremendous number. And it's, again, a reflection of the size of the resource because it is so large. The project can source Asian markets for decades, source in-state markets for decades, decades longer, and be able to have an infrastructure that makes both work. An infrastructure of this complexity to simply source one-tenth of the market for in-state use is much more difficult. It lacks what's called economy of scale. There's simply just not enough demand to underpin a project of this size. So by connecting it to a larger market, to treat the gas, transport the gas, and liquefy the gas, the project can generate revenues that can make it possible in this environment. Now, would it be economic in today's environment? It's hard to say. But the way we measure that is by what's called cost of supply. That's where we take all the money that we'd have to spend, which is roughly $45 to $65 billion based on early estimates to build it, plus all the billions to operate it over 30 years, put that all into a big pot and divide it by the 35 trillion cubic feet of gas that we'd move and say, for every million BTUs of gas that we move, we've had to spend this much money. And whatever that number is, you have to make sure that that number is less than what the buyer pays you for it so that there's something left over. Something left over for the lenders and investors, which is why Alaskans as owners and you as the board of directors want to ask yourself, is there enough here that it makes sense? Do these risks make sense, and is there enough margin that this makes sense for me? And if not, how do I work together with the other parties to make that work, because I have both a short-term spend question that our team is working very, very hard to drive down short-term costs, but more importantly, we have this long-term cost of supply question. And cost of supply is the metric that decides whether a project lives or dies, because the market decides, is this cost of supply competitive? Can I get this gas from somebody else for less? I like to say, and I probably said it too much, this isn't Copper River Salmon. Nobody will pay extra for this gas. You know, Copper River Salmon demands a premium because it is a better salmon, and everybody can recognize that. Gas is a commodity. It can't be differentiated. So you can't go to a market and see a higher price for one gas versus another gas, because any molecule of gas looks exactly like every other molecule of gas, and it competes purely on cost. So that's what really matters. Now.
So Steve?
Yes.
First of all, I want to welcome Senator Stedman, who joined us several minutes ago. But so here's the question that constituents also ask us. We see the demand in China diminishing. We see many projects around the world coming online. Why do we think we'll be able to sell our gas, this large quantity, 2.4 billion cubic feet? Mm-hmm. How would you respond?
Okay, that's a great question, Senator Giesel. I would say that as LNG demand grows with population growth and people's desire to have better standards of living, they have to make decisions about how they provide energy to their economies. And I think LNG is a cleaner form of energy than a lot of energy that is consumed in places like China right now. There's terrific air quality issues, and there's terrific concern about the broader energy mix that folks use in the world. And as folks look really hard at how do I get my energy, if they care about the long-term impacts of that, they can shift to places like natural gas, where you can have a cleaner burning fuel that allows them to bridge to other technologies. And I think that creates this demand. And all the studies from any of the parties, as well as third parties, will indicate that as an energy source, LNG is growing faster than any other energy source. So there is a demand out there. What's happening is there is more potential sources of supply. So our competition is to try and find ways to make Alaska LNG, which is very close to the market, as competitive as those other sources. And the way we can do that is by working together and using the resources that all the parties can bring to bear to drive down our cost of supply. Okay. To that end,
Thank you. I do want to welcome Senator Wilkowski to the committee.
And to that end, there's a poll.
And Senator Stoltz had a question, Steve.
Thank you, Madam Chair. When Mr. Butt was using one of the potential outlets for our marketing, he's kind of used the same kind of ambiguous, amorphous term Governor Walker uses, Asian markets. And it's, I think it's almost like a kind of a careless term, and it doesn't really give us much guidance, and it's more of a political term. And I was just kind of shocked you use the same term the governor uses. And what does that mean, and how would you define it, really dissect into what it really means for Alaska? It's almost like saying we got good stuff, Asian market.
Okay. Senator Schultz, through the chair. We use the phrase Asian markets to describe all the different buyers that are in Asia. There's many countries, and they all have LNG receiving terminals because they lack indigenous resources. I don't talk about more specific buyers because as a group of sellers, it's anti-competitive of us to talk about different strategies until we've defined exactly how we want to work together and how the different parties want to market their gas. One of the issues that there's going to be some folks in here on Wednesday that you could open the conversation with them on is, how does that all look? Because under antitrust guidelines, we really can't talk about the different markets. And there's a lot of different things out there. But since all the parties are competitors, it's inappropriate and it's illegal for us to say, well, this is the right market and here's why and this is what we think we can do. It would be construed as collusion, and so we stay away from it. And I'm not trying to use a term of art or be imprecise. It's just to be more precise would be outside the law.
Follow-up, Senator Schultz?
I guess might be helpful, Madam Chair, instead of Asian markets, we're talking about potential Asian customers that actually bring their checkbook to the conversation or bring a line of credit, something. And everybody is generally polite when you bring over a trade mission. Even folks I'm even polite to family I don't want to see sometimes. It's, I mean, but and I'm not trying to be trite, but it's as we're talking about these things and Asian markets, it's almost become a frustrating term, and it's my constituents are trying to get a grasp. They want to know what that means, and without getting into the non-competitive, but you say, well, these are people that actually have money and interest, and certainly anybody selling can differentiate between somebody who's a serious potential customer or not, and I think without being a non-competitive, we could take our slideshow everywhere. I'm sure there's only some places you're going to take your traveling show, not yours or anybody else's, that's going on missions. But with that kind of vague and kind of broad question, Madam Chair.
Through the Chair, Senator Schultz, I hear you. I'm not quite sure if I'm getting the question there, but I guess I could just say that I would respectfully say you're thinking like an owner. You're thinking like a seller, and that's great. To the extent we can answer some of these questions in public forum is really limited. So maybe what's best is, if I could, would be to recommend that the chair consider engaging your counsel, Analytica, your advisors. They can give you all that data. It's all available. But if I give it to you, it's illegal. So I really can't. But it's all available to you.
All right.
And Madam Chair, maybe there's another public official who hasn't signed confidentiality agreements can share stuff with us.
Thank you, Senator Chair. Stoltz. Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I think on that subject, one thing that might make it a little clearer for not only the committee but for the public is if we had the time, Madam Chairman, to have a presentation with available public data on the growth of the world energy markets worldwide. It's, I know Exxon does that every year. BP does it every year. A lot of other companies do it. We can have somebody put that stuff together, and we can actually take a look at what the expectations of the growth in the Asian market, the African continent, or any other place, what they are, and how many people in India and China don't have electricity. I don't think there's any question that the growth of energy is going to increase in the next several generations. There's too many people that don't have lights and electric motors. It's that simple.
Thank you, Senator Stedman. I don't see any other questions. I'll let you proceed, Steve.
So kind of back to the nature of the project, to introduce its purposes is to treat, transport, and liquefy gas through the construction of a gas treatment facility, a pipeline, and a liquefaction facility. We're trying to leverage a couple real advantages here in Alaska, which is back to your core question of what makes this project have a chance and what doesn't. I can talk a little bit about the advantages and disadvantages, and what I would suggest is the fact that we have this location in Alaska is actually a big advantage. And I've mentioned this to some audiences before, but the simple fact that the air in Alaska is colder than in a lot of places where LNG is manufactured helps LNG plants in Alaska be 10 to 15% more efficient. You can get 10 to 15% more LNG out of the equipment that you build without paying more money, simply because the air here is colder and drier. The dry air helps. It helps with the longevity of the machinery. It helps them run better. So turbo machinery likes cold, dry air, and Alaska has that. It may sound trite, but it's actually a huge issue. The other factor is Alaska is in the northern hemisphere. And I know that also sounds a little bit silly, but buyers are in the northern hemisphere, and they want more LNG in the winter, January and February, when the turbo machinery in Alaska is more efficient, generating more LNG, so that projects in the southern hemisphere are disadvantaged because they have seasonality out of sync with their buyers, and they have to build a lot of capacity to handle winter demand in the northern hemisphere when they're dealing with hotter temperatures in the southern hemisphere. Those couple factors, combined with the fact that Alaska is very close to the market, are huge advantages. The other really big advantage that I just want to take a second on is the Prudhoe Bay resource is well known. We don't have to drill a lot of wells, and when we talk with federal regulators and we talk with folks about getting the permits we need to do this project, we always bring back the fact that this resource is known, the wells are drilled, the Prudhoe Bay operator's done a great job managing the gas to maximize oil production for 30 years and recycle the gas to keep the energy in the reservoir, and has that capacity and that compression in place. A lot of projects have to build that. They have to drill those wells. They have to add that investment. Alaska LNG doesn't, because it can leverage the existing fields, and those existing fields are a huge advantage that we can't overlook. Now, you need all those advantages to offset the two big disadvantages, which is back to the big three letters that I point out at the top of that page, CO2. We have to move 4 trillion cubic feet of CO2 over the life of this project. I've tried many times to find a good analog for CO2. A can of Coke has 4 grams of CO2. It's hundreds of trillions of cans of Coke equivalent of CO2. It's a staggering number. It's twice as much as the state of Alaska uses in terms of all of its energy every day. And we have to have a facility to remove all that LNG, and that's why there are no projects anywhere in the world handling this much CO2, because it's very expensive. And you can't start the project until you get the CO2 out, and the reason is CO2 freezes at a much lower temperature. CO2 freezes at about minus 50 Fahrenheit. So if you're trying to process the gas and get it cold to ship, if there's anything in that stream other than methane, it will freeze very early. And once it all freezes, the whole facility is locked up and you can't operate anymore. So now you've spent all this money and you can't operate. So you have to get all these impurities out. You have to get all these non-simple hydrocarbon molecules like methane and ethane out early. And that's what the gas treatment plant does. And what little gets through the gas treatment plant comes down to the liquefaction facility where it's finally stripped. And then it's removed, and it's all that's left at the end of the day is simple molecules, methane and ethane, which is the gas that Senator Stedman referenced that folks all over the world need. There's in excess of 1 billion people without access to hydrocarbon energy. I mean, they need that, and there's a lot of growth for that. But you have to use all those advantages to offset that really big disadvantage that half the cost of our project is just to get the gas cleaned up and moved to the plant. So those were kind of the background questions to characterize the project.
Senator Stedman.
Thank you, Madam Chairman. On the couple of things I didn't really think about much is that the cost advantage that you'd mentioned about our atmosphere here, the temperature and stuff. And then the other one is, you know, when we, and I assume by looking at your flow diagram and that we're going to depressurize Point Thompson because it's extremely high pressure and then put the byproduct into Prudhoe for enhanced oil recovery. Is there, you know, any limitations on how much we can put in, reinject in the Prudhoe, or will it take everything forever we can stuff in there to repressurize it, or do you have any comments on that?
Through the chair to Senator Stedman, Point Thompson is a high pressure system. It's about 10,000 PSI. But it's not nearly as big as Prudhoe. And Prudhoe has been produced for a very, very long time. The amount of fluids that have been taken out of Prudhoe is much larger. So we have confidence that we can remove the CO2 from Point Thompson, which is only 4%, and put it back into Prudhoe Bay over the life of this project. And one of the things I'll mention on the next slide is those were some of the things that were discussed by the Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson operator, not the project, but the folks who run the fields with the AOGCC as a regulator, to get AOGCC's endorsement to take gas out of the fields for potential gas export.
Senator Wilkowski.
Thank you. Two questions. Number one, just on the overall prospects, do you see long-term prices? Senate Finance set up projections for long-term oil prices. Do you see... Can you give us an update on long-term LNG prices, I guess, in the Asian market or worldwide? And then number two would be, do you see costs dropping with the commodities plunging all around the world, not just oil, gas, but steel and just about everything else, to a point where it could make this project more competitive?
Okay. Through the chair, Senator Wilkowski. I can't help you much on price forecasting. I always enjoy looking at people who forecast prices, and I always look at how they did based on their forecast from a couple years ago, and I haven't met many folks who get it right. So I wouldn't even try to do that. I hope you'll understand. I'm not trying to duck the question. It's just I don't know anybody who knows how to get that right. And I think what's way more important than asking is the price right is asking is the cost of supply right? Can you get the cost of supply low enough so that when markets go up and down, there's still a margin? And that is what I do. That's the only thing I do. That's what our team does, is we drive down the long-term cost of supply to try and say, this is the smallest amount of money you can spend to get the gas off the North Slope connected to buyers who need the energy. And that is the question that then I would respectfully suggest you as owners, as the board of directors for the owners, ask yourself, well, do I think there's enough room between that number and whatever that future is that this project makes sense? That's the question you have to ask for yourselves. And there's all kinds of folks who would be happy to help you. Consultants would love to give you information on that, but that's outside my wheelhouse, and I would know I would get it wrong. Now, to the second part of your question, I can help you there. We have seen a lot of movement in commodities. Steel is a lot cheaper today than it was a year ago. We have made some moves around how we're resourcing work, where we've seen some companies come up with some really good resources that can help us do work cheaper that we've been able to take advantage of. Any time you talk about the energy business, one of the most important things to remember is one of the most important elements of the energy business is energy itself. It takes a lot of energy to make energy. So if energy is cheaper, that cost input goes down. But again, the way we measure all that is the cost of supply. Is the cost of steel coming down enough that it really matters in the pipeline? Are the compression equipment getting cheaper? Are the turbo machinery getting cheaper? And what we're seeing is material costs are moving, but some of finished products, process modules, machinery, big vessels are not. So that's kind of what we're learning, and I can share that with you. And that all rolls into our pre-FEED analysis, and I'll be talking about it more on some of the subsequent slide. But it all comes back to cost of supply, and I welcome all the questions that let me talk about cost of supply. I said earlier with some of the folks that my favorite four-letter word is cost and risk. And the two four-letter words we spend all our time talking about are cost and risk. So anything on that, happy to talk about.
Excuse me, Steve. I just wanted to welcome Senator Bishop. He is in the audience joining us today.
Okay. So that's the quick overview. Treat, transport, liquefy. We have some advantages. We have some disadvantages. It'll all come down to cost. And so I want to give everybody kind of a status update on what we've done since we last talked in September. We completed all the work in 2015 incident-free, and I really want to take this opportunity to publicly recognize all the teams that worked for Alaska LNG here in Alaska and in other places, but primarily doing the summer field work. We did somewhere on the order of 300,000 person hours of work with some local Alaskan companies gathering the data we need for the resource reports. They did all that work without any incident. No recordables of any form, and we're just really pleased. That means in 4 years we've had one recordable incident, which was in early 2014. So we're working hard to build what we call culture of caring. We focus a lot on what we talk about as safe choices, where we plan our work and everybody knows what they're doing so that they can think about it and choose to execute it in a manner that's safely, so that when they make the millions of decisions that they make every day to do the things that they do them in a safe manner. And we're really grateful that they did that, and I just wanted to recognize them for that. I also want to update this slide. We provided it earlier when we hadn't closed the December books. We closed them out at $376 million, so the final year-end 2015 number. So we called this December 2015. It wasn't through the end of 2015 because we hadn't done all the closings. But through the end of 2015, excuse me, we spent $376 million on pre-feed. That was $83 million in 2014, $293 million in 2015, and that's in addition to the $107 million we spent on concept. So all in, it's just short of $500 million in work on the project to date. I'll show you a little bit more breakdown on my last slide, but those are our current spend numbers. Our design work is about 85% complete on the base JVA design, which is what we agreed to execute in June of 2014. We've since added work for the 48-inch pipeline, so if you add that scope of work in and the optimization work, it's a little bit less because it's more work than we said we were going to do, but we remain on track to get that done. So we're on schedule liquidating the work as designed. I'll talk a little bit more about our forward decision milestones. We are getting everything done for what we call our base cost and schedule estimates, and again, the project will bring to you as the board for the owners the data that we have on cost and schedule to try and take a harder look on that $45 to $65 billion range and say, this is what we're seeing. This is what we think it means in terms of cost of supply. This is what we think it means in terms of schedule, and this is what we think it means in terms of regulatory risk. So that is a pre-feed deliverable that we have every confidence we will complete this year in 2016 under the approved budget that was endorsed by all the parties. The other milestones I know I talked about back in September, so I'll be really quick, because we finished the FERC draft in early 2015. We got the export authorizations, both free trade and non-free trade, in 2015, and we're really proud of that. Got them quicker than most, and makes AKLNG one of only a handful of projects that has the legal right to export gas from the United States. And then I wanted to thank the Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson operators, as I mentioned earlier, that through their work with the AOGCC, they removed a significant risk. And it may be something that we didn't all think about, but a lot of the work we were doing on Alaska LNG was in confidence that we would get the regulatory right to actually take gas out of the fields, whereas in early 2014, we didn't have that. Even when we talked in September, that wasn't done. So the Prudhoe Bay and Point Thompson operator did a lot of work with the AOGCC and got the regulators' endorsement to take gas out of those fields for an export project, whatever that means. We have that right now, which is a risk that we didn't have resolved a year ago. So that was some good progress. In 2016, we're going to continue to finish the pre-FEED work, which is cost and schedule and design. We're going to continue progressing the environmental impact statement. We think it's a very important critical path regulatory activity that ties everything together. The first step is to finish the 48-inch pipeline option. As you may recall, in September, there were some questions, and it was an open issue. But since then, all the parties agreed to put about $30 million into analysis of the 48-inch pipeline. We think we can do that a little less. I'll show you on the pipeline page. Probably going to do that for maybe $26, $27 million. We're going to try and be able to make a decision in April of 2016. We've been talking with the state gas team, and we've made sure that their representatives are going to be involved in the review process so that they can see the analysis on both the 42-inch system and the 48-inch system and understand cost and execution risks, so that when we talk about how we get to the decision, we'll all have common data. And we may get to different views on that because risk is an inherently subjective process, but we'll have common data on those two elements and try and get to that decision in April of 2016. We're going to finish the geotechnical and geophysical work. That's what the acronym G&G means, to support the resource reports, and that's where we gather soil borings and field data to demonstrate that the project can be built in a safe manner. That second draft resource report is in process now. We'll start submitting it to the FERC probably next month through May. We've submitted in phases, and I'll show you a slide in a little bit on it. And as I mentioned here, as part of this process, we'll continue providing the owners information to support a FEED decision. And the last slide I have, we'll talk a lot more about that, but this whole process is to make sure everybody has that information so that they can consider what's best for the future, not only of the project, but for the constituents they represent. As always, I like to touch on three messages in every opportunity. First is, this is an integrated project. I mentioned that on the earlier page. About half the cost of this project is the LNG plant, 25% is the gas plant, and the remaining 25% is the pipeline. All the pieces have to work together for the project to work, and each of the pieces in isolation isn't as going to be successful because the project is so big, and it can only be effective if we can drive down that cost, which is the second bullet. Everything comes down to cost of supply because we're competing in a global market and low cost wins. It's all about who can deliver the commodity at the lowest price. And as Senator Wilikowski asked earlier, and you alluded to earlier, Chairwoman Giesel, people know prices are low today. They see that. They see it every day on the news. So we have kind of a dual challenge of getting our near-term spend down while minimizing our cost of supply. But the fact that prices today are different than what people thought they were 6 months ago is, to me, what's far more important than projecting them in the future. I think what we learn every time we look at prices is we don't predict them very well. So what we have to do is look at what we do know, which is cost of supply, and say, if we invest this much money in capital and this much money to run the project, to deliver this much gas, is that, in terms of dollars per millions of BTUs, going to be competitive? Because the market tells you every day what they're willing to pay for that commodity. The question is, can you deliver it for less than that? And that's the question we want to provide the information to and have the conversation on over the next 9 to 12 months. because, you know, as I like to say, if you're not making money on a unit cost basis, if you're not covering the cost of every molecule of LNG you sell, if you're making it for more than you can sell it, if you're losing money on a unit cost basis, you can't make up for it on volume. You will always get into trouble, and that's the nature of the LNG business. The money's spent up front and recovered over time. So you have to have confidence that you can do it in a competitive manner. The last point is always talking a little bit about alignment, risk, and cost. Alignment's critical. As I referenced earlier, we have the four parties together. To your question on what makes this project different, what gives it a chance, all four parties are talking to each other, looking at the issues, looking at the risks together. That's not been done before, so while I respect the skepticism of a lot of folks who've seen gas projects start and stop, start and stop, start and stop, they want to know, you know, this one started, will it stop? And the answer to that question, I think, turns back to them. Point I'd like to suggest is, if people are willing to work together to find alignment to reduce risk and reduce cost and do the work necessary to make that happen, it's a self-fulfilling prophecy. You're more likely to be successful, whereas if you're confident it's not going to work and you're not willing to work to make it happen and you're confident that it's not going to be something that you want to invest your time and energy in, you're probably going to be right there too. So whether you think you can make it work or you think you can't make it work, you might be right. And I really think that's an important issue that you as the owners of, you as the board for the owners might want to think about, is how do we create that alignment to get to that path of success? Because we've invested about $500 million to come up with a system that's maturing through the regulatory process. And how do we have confidence that we want to move it forward? And I'll show you two more slides on that a little later.
Senator Stoltz.
Thank you. I guess it just to help me navigate this, what now the four owners are all together, including the state, is there a solid consensus on what the state's ownership level is, and secondly, how the state will finance it, whether it's bonds, using the permanent fund? I mean, as the partners, I assume you talk about what each participant's ability is to pay, and what's the... Those are things there still seems to be ambiguity in the public, that sometimes they say, well, we're going to collateralize the permanent fund and pay for it, and now we've got a plan that to use the permanent fund more aggressively to pay for government. And my constituents back home, when I was in the greatest town hall you can go to, a gun show, some of them said, how's the government going to use the permanent fund twice, once for the gas line and once for the to pay for government? And so back to the question, what's the partner's understanding of the state's level of participation and the anticipation of how the state will pay for it? Because I assume that does come up in a discussion. People want to see each other's commitments and checkbooks, and that there seems to be a lot of ambiguity in the public arena of where the state's position is, and maybe the partners have fleshed something out with each other.
Okay. Senator Stoltz, through the chair, I'll try and help you with that in pieces. SB 138 defined the state's share of the project at 25%, which was part of the conversations that led up to that. So I think that's pretty well known in public. The more detailed question I think you're asking about, you know, is how is the state going to finance its share? Again, that's kind of outside my wheelhouse. You're going to have representatives from each of the companies come share their view as companies on Wednesday. So I'll make sure they're aware that you have that question, but I'm going to recommend that probably the only person who can really answer how the state's thinking about financing its share is probably the state. And I know it would be inappropriate for me to presume to answer that.
Thank you. So those, Madam Chair, those questions will be left hanging to get more elaboration.
We have other guests joining us further along in the week. So, yeah.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
Cool. Just to keep kind of building out the rest of the work that the team's done, I wanted to give everybody a quick update on the integrated design. And I'll keep this really quick, because to me this is very exciting stuff, because it's detailed compositional modeling and hydraulic modeling of one of the largest LNG systems. But at a very core level, what we have done is built a model that helps us understand how all the pieces talk to each other. We know what the gas looks like and all the other components of the gas look like from the two fields. We know how it comes into the gas treatment plant. We know how the byproducts and the CO2 get returned to Prudhoe Bay. We know the elements of that. We know how the pipeline looks. We know how the LNG plant looks. And we can really model that in great detail. And just as a quick example of the importance of that, because it might sound a little trite, if we change the discharge temperature of the compression systems at Point Thompson by as little as 10 degrees, we move hundreds of barrels of liquids across the entire system. So just a couple degrees variance moves hundreds of barrels, hundreds of miles, because the whole system is talking to each other all the time. It's a very integrated system. And so what we've done is we've been able to model it so that we can do what we call fit-for-purpose project specifications, making sure the machinery everywhere is balanced, that it's appropriate for its purpose, and that it's as efficient as possible, and that comes back to cost. We want to make sure that we are as cost-effective as possible. We've then gone to the next step to model what we call reliability, availability, and maintainability, and since we're lazy, we use lots of acronyms, and our acronym is RAM. To make sure that the equipment we purchase in any part of the system can work with all the other parts of the system, that when we are working on turbo machinery in the gas treatment plant, we have a corresponding plan to work on machinery in the LNG plant, so that we don't have machinery in one part of the system down for maintenance when machinery in the other part of the system needs to be operating, and that we look over a 40-year period at every sort of piece of equipment that we're thinking about in the maintenance cycles, because if you think about the equipment that you own, whether it's a car or a motorcycle or an ATV, you change the oil differently. You have different maintenance activities you have to do to keep those machines running. It's no different on this. So what we have to do is understand the maintenance cycles on all the machinery so that when we look out 40 years and we make our decisions on cost, we're thinking about the whole system over the whole life of the project so that we don't find in 20 years we have to have multiple things down because we have maintenance issues in different places, that we've thought about what is the type of equipment we've selected and what is the maintenance cycle on that and does it fit. And we've done it in the context of how all that works. And that's a very important element of cost reduction and optimization to help make sure that these systems run for 40 years.
Senator Wilkowski.
Is the gas at Point Thompson treated the same as Pluto? Is that the same, similar type of composition, or is you have to treat the gas differently?
Okay. Through the chair? No. Senator Wilkowski, through the chair. You treat it the same, it's just the amount of it is very different. The rate coming out of Point Thompson is about one quarter of the input rate, and it's only got 4% CO2. So if you think 0.25 times 0.04, Prudhoe Bay contributes the rest, three quarters, at 12%, 0.75 plus times 0.125. All that goes into the same acid gas rejection unit. It's just the amount of CO2 that Point Thompson is contributing is a fraction of what point of Prudhoe Bay, because Prudhoe Bay is a very big number and Point Thompson is a very little number. But the system, once those two streams are blended, is exactly the same. And the way it works is we take gas into a large reaction tower, and we let the gas come up through the tower, and we wash it down with a chemical called amine. And the chemical is a very long chain, and it has the ability to grab everything that isn't hydrocarbon and bind it in with the liquid. And it goes out the bottom, and everything that's hydrocarbon comes off the top. And everything that comes off the top goes into the pipeline. And everything that comes off the bottom goes into a reboiler where that liquid is then heated up. And when it's heated up, it releases everything that isn't a hydrocarbon. And everything that comes off that reboiler tower is now an impurity, which is CO2. It's almost all CO2. And that's moved over into Prudhoe Bay so it can be put back in the ground where it came from. So the treating process is exactly the same. It's the amount of contribution of CO2 from the two is dramatically different. And that's why you can do so much more with a blended system, because together it's only about 10% CO2. By itself, Prudhoe Bay is 12% CO2.
Steve, I just want to interject. We have about 25 minutes
okay.
left.
We'll go fast. He asked me about acid gas rejection. That's that was too much
got
fun.
You going,
that
I know.
That's too much
got
fun. So on the LNG side, what we've done is finished the marine modeling to demonstrate we can receive all the materials we need. We have the equipment to receive large modules. We have the equipment to load, offload. It's the picture in the upper right. We finished the layout design. I'm going to show you a video of some of the navigation simulation work we've been able to do with the AvTech facility in Seward here on the next slide, how all that work is done. We've been able to finish geotechnical de-risking by drilling 61 onshore boreholes, 25 offshore boreholes. And I think what I can really say is all the information we've gathered is consistent with what we expected, that the the soils in the area of our analysis and investigation appear appropriate. We've still got some more work to do. We've done a lot of seafloor mapping, and we're using that all in our design. As we go forward, we have a long list of things that we think we can save money on: how we build the facility, how we source the turbines, how we manage the current. Because we've split the plant, we manage power very differently than a traditional LNG plant, and we think there's a lot of saving there. And then we're looking really hard at storage. Storage is very expensive because LNG is always trying to return to a gaseous state. So we want to be efficient and move our LNG from the plant to the ships with a minimum amount of storage, but you always have to have some storage to allow for when ships are coming and going. So we're trying to really optimize that. And we're doing all that to make sure we can ship in the right way for 40 years. So let me show you real quickly a quick video of how we've done the simulation for all the offloading and offloading. It was done with a facility called Avtec. It's in Seward. And we did it in conjunction with the Alaska pilots and some pilots on the team. So what they do is they come up with the design of the system they're going to use. They analyze it. They feed it all into the simulators. They call in to the simulated bridge. This bridge is exactly like if you were on a ship. It has all the same controls. It's managed exactly the same. And if you look out the screen, what they're seeing is a 3D simulation as though you're in a ship that's moving. So what they're seeing is always moving with all the controls live being controlled through the simulation system. And so they're always acting as though they're in the ship moving. And if you move the camera around, you can see this is the facility down there in Seward. And once they get all the information, they bring it back into the control room and debrief it. And up on the screens, you can see the inlet where they're doing all the work. And so that work's been done, and it's allowed us to finish the jetty design. So, and on the pipeline side, we finished the 42-inch testing, and I'm going to show you a little bit more on that. But what we've basically been able to do is get material on 42-inch pipe from three mills, one in the U.S., two outside the U.S. And what we do is we simulate coating that pipe to make sure that any impacts on the material from heating the pipe, because installing coating requires very high temperatures, any impact on the pipe from what we call post-heat treatment can be simulated in what we do with just called tensile testing and compression testing, which is done under the direction of PHMSA, which is the Pipeline Hazardous Material Safety Administration. They're the group that define what tests have to be done to satisfy them that the design is appropriate. And what we're really trying to do is design a bunch of worst-case scenarios and prove that the pipe can perform properly and maintain integrity in the event of all these bad things happening. So on the tensile test, what we do is we cut sections about 8 feet long and create about a 20-foot section to test two sets of welds, and then we machine in imperfections at PHMSA's direction, and then we stretch the pipe. So that's about an 18-foot section of pipe, but after it's stretched, it goes to about 19 feet. So you've demonstrated the ability to stretch this 42-inch pipe using somewhere between 10 and 20 million pounds of work and just pull it. Now, I'd show you a video of it, but it's kind of like watching grass grow, watching a piece of pipe kind of stretched. It's not very dramatic, but it's a tremendous amount of force. It's the equivalent of taking 3,000 Ford F-150s, putting them in a bag, and picking it up. It's a huge amount of load. So what we've been able to do with that is demonstrate a wide range of scenarios to PHMSA satisfaction. The other thing we do is test what's called compression, which is where you take the pipe and you push it from either end to test its deformation and bend, and demonstrate that it will maintain integrity under those same loads. And here what we do is we depressurize the pipe, because when the pipe is under pressure, it's incredibly hard to compress because it's so strong with just the pressure of the gas inside. But we drop the pressure way down and we push it from either side with somewhere on the order of 8 to 10 million pounds of load again. And I'm going to show you a quick video of what that looks like. This is a 6-hour test. We do many of these tests at different characteristics with all the pipe. And we measure about 36,000 different points. Each one of those red squares is a grid to test any motion in the pipe. So here's what happens over a 6-hour period when you exert 8 million pounds of force on it. Over time, it starts to shift, and then it starts to buckle. But what you've noticed is you haven't lost integrity. It's simply deformed. So what we've demonstrated to PHMSA is over a wide range of characteristics, the X70 material from the three mills all passes, and which is what we really want, because we can get it from multiple sources and it's met a lot of different characteristics. As we go forward, we have to do the 48-inch pipe. We won't receive that pipe till April, so we'll make our decision on 42 versus 48 about the same time on the presumption that we'll be able to make the material pass. We're very confident we can do that, but we have to demonstrate it to the regulator's satisfaction. And for cost reduction, we're trying to make sure that the pipeline route and gravel requirements and camps and design are as efficient as possible. And that's one of the big elements of 42 versus 48 that we look at is cost and execution risk, because a bigger pipe needs a bigger trench, deeper hole, much bigger side booms, much bigger right-of-ways. It needs a lot more equipment to move. You can move three joints of, you can see in the upper right picture, you can move three joints of 42-inch on a truck. You can only move two joints of 48-inch, so you need an extra 50% more trucks. Everything is 30 to 50% more difficult because the weight is so much higher. One joint of 42-inch pipe is equivalent to about two Ford F-150s. One joint of 48 is equivalent to about three F-150s. Everything goes up between 30 and 50% in terms of weight and complexity. And what we want to understand is how does that manage? And this goes back to Senator Wilkowski's question is, as steel is dropping, if other things aren't, does it shift the math in? And that's what we're looking at, and we'll have that decision. Hopefully, by the time we have our next update, we'll schedule it after that decision, and that information we can bring it to you.
Great. Steve Simon-Machicki had a question.
Just two quick ones, Steve. Thank you, Madam Chair. And component costs generally lag behind material costs, right? Eventually, engineering frees up in manufacturing, and yep. Hopefully we could take advantage of that with the timing of the project. But my question is more directed toward on the 42 versus 48 decision. As a member of this board of directors, I have no interest in funding Blue Sky. So tell me how that process might work with the four partners on making a final decision and sort of a all-in consideration to get there.
Okay. Senator Machicki through the chair. It's a really good question. You know, the death of a mega project is pre-investment, spending money that you don't have to. Anything that compromises cost of supply is the last thing we want to do. But what we want to do in the 42 versus 48 is ask ourselves, can we remove enough compression from a 48-inch pipe to make the reduction in the compression facilities be offset by the increase in the pipe? Because we'll need about 1.2 million tons of steel for a 42-inch system. We'll need about 1.8 million tons of steel for a 48-inch system. That's going to cost you more. That's guaranteed because you're buying more pipe. But you're going to buy less compression. The question then will get to be, what do you think about the execution risk? What do you think about the bigger right-of-ways? What do you think about the extra equipment, the extra truckloads? How do you feel about that? And can you get comfortable that the cost of supply isn't compromised such that you've either got a trade-off or you don't, or you can at least quantify the trade-off and talk about it as a group and say, this is what the trade-off is. We have said in the past that based on the data that we've had previously that we are now updating, we see somewhere on the order of several hundred million dollars of differential with the bigger system because the pipe costs more than offset by the reduction in the compression costs. As we update that, we want to take a hard look at that and be able to say we've given both systems the same level of work, which we can't say right now. We can say that we know a 42-inch system meets our needs at the lowest cost of supply based on the analysis we've done. One of the participants asked for some more work to take a look at it and retest that balance. We've done that, and we've agreed with the state gas team and the DNR that we'll have their participants in the room so that we all have the common data, because I'll be sitting in the exact same place you are. If we can't get the costs and risks kind of in a place where we can understand them, you'll have to take a hard look at it, because it's been pre-investment, and pre-investment is tough on a project because you're spending money. You're betting on the come. You're spending money hoping that something happens. And if you get that right, you've compromised every dollar you've spent. Or if you get that wrong, you've compromised every dollar you've spent. So we're looking at it, and it's probably best to say next time we come and talk about it, we'll be much better informed than we are right now. Okay, so on the gas treatment plant, they've done a ton of work working with the Prudhoe Bay operator. And again, I'd like to thank the Prudhoe Bay operator for everything they've done around the integrated nature of the project. The map that you see up there is Prudhoe Bay up on the upper right. That's the west dock. The road comes down to that little squiggly shape. That's the GTP layout. We've been able to demonstrate how we would get the gravel we need. The Putt 23 mine was started in 1974. It's been the basis of the gravel that they used up there. They've mined about 18 million cubic yards from it. we're going to need between 6 and 8, which means we're going to need a new source. And what we've been able to do is test the gravel from this potential source and demonstrate that we can get the gravel we need, we can get the water we need. This is another big risk that we had uncertainty on a year ago. Can you get the gravel? Can you get the water? And we've been able to, what we say, de-risk that and have confidence that that pit run gravel picture you see up there is adequate for building the base of the GTP. That's one of the most expensive parts of the layout. So as we go forward, we want to keep doing work to reduce the weight of the facilities, optimize the layout, think about the machinery and the electrical design, really, you know, take a hard look, because as I said, one of the big challenges of this project is you have to handle so much CO2 before you even get anything in the line. So that's a big part of it. We're going to be looking hard at the camp and the layout. We switched the camp based on some recent work that the team's real proud of, and we think will help the facility be a lot safer. And so all that work's been done and to de-risk the GTP, but it's still a place we look really, really hard, because it's a place where we're not as advantaged as the weather and other elements of this project. We've also done a lot of work on the labor study, and again, you can go through all these numbers at your leisure, but I think the best way to look at it is the detailed analysis of the labor demand that we're going to need through a lot of work with lots of folks here in Alaska and a broad range of industry, and I thank the Department of Labor and Commissioner Dreigas for all of her work to support it. Is the earlier estimates of about 9,000 to 10,000 workers, up to 15,000 with seasonal demands, seems about right. And we've layered it all in. That's the picture in the upper right. But what we keep testing is, where are we going to get that labor? It's going to be tough. It's going to be really hard to get that labor because there aren't that many folks with the right skills available. And so we're looking at different strategies to do that. And the second picture on there, I think, is really important. It's a picture of all the labor forecasting demands for all the different projects that they're able to know about today. And what you can see is, for the next several years, there's a lot of work in the western U.S., and it kind of looks like it goes away. It doesn't really go away. The forecaster's ability to understand it goes away, because there's no data out there anymore. Nobody says, I'm going to build this in 4 years. So that demand goes away. What really happens is those big bars that you see early in that graph, they just keep going. And I make 2 points about that. Number one, the demand for Alaska LNG labor is about the same as all the western U.S. on that graph. That's how much we need. So just trying to put it in context, it's a tremendous amount of labor. And if you extend that graph, knowing the shortcomings of the forecasting process, you're putting all that labor on top of a continuing amount of a lot of work. And that gets back to Senator Machicki's point, is does the current environment change any of that? So far we aren't seeing that, but the senator is absolutely correct. That lags. You see the shift in materials early, you see the lag in services and technical capability later. We're not seeing it yet, so we're looking for that. Where we want to really make sure we understand it is our labor sourcing strategy. Where are you going to get that labor? How's it going to work? And that's our focus there. On the logistics side,
Senator Costello, did you have a question?
I did. Thank you.
Steve, is that labor report, is that public right now?
Through the chairs, Senator Costello, it's not. It's not 100% done yet, but we can find ways to work with the Department of Labor to share key elements of it.
Thank you. And a follow-up?
Yes, follow-up.
As we look to reduce the cost of government, and we'll be looking at the Department of Labor's budget, are there programs that you find particularly valuable as related to the pipeline project?
Through the chair, Senator Costello, I'd need to come back to you on that one. Let me come back in the next update and try and answer that question.
Thank you.
So in terms of logistics, that's the other big area we're kind of looking hard at. How do you move the materials? Road, rail, sea, air. What we really want to do is try and make sure we don't move anything but people by air, and all the materials move either by road, rail, or sea. Because air is very expensive, and if we plan properly, we should be able to get all the materials where they need to be some other way, and then you put the people there to actually execute the work. We've designed work scopes and movement strategies for each of the key areas along the system, looked at the amount of trucks that are going to need for this. It's hundreds of thousands of trucks. It's just It's the scope and the scale that we're looking at. So what we're trying to do now is optimize different parts of the project to make sure that when we use certain equipment for delivery in one place, we can maybe use it again somewhere else later. We're minimizing our sea lifts, trying to make sure we're as efficient as we can, because moving equipment and people as part of the logistics is one of the most important elements of the project, not just from cost, but being able to be effective. Because if you don't move everything right and you don't have the material in the right place at the right time, you can't execute efficiently, and that compromises cost. So we're looking at that. We're working hard on contracting with local Alaskan companies to make sure we marry up global LNG experience with local Alaskan skills. We have the ak-lng.com website, where about 700 local Alaskan companies have registered. And what we'll be doing as we go forward on contracting is kind of having market engagement and networking forums so that the local Alaskan companies can get to know some of the global LNG players. And we can try and get some feedback from the companies on things they're thinking in terms of execution efficiencies and strategies, because we know that the local Alaskan companies have a lot of experience in, you know, doing the work here the right way, state regulations, community engagement, all the requirements. So you want to capture that knowledge early and work it into the design. And so we'll be having forums here in the second quarter with the folks who have registered on the website. We do business information sessions. We've done some of those in 2015. They went really well. I noticed that the colors are kind of lost, so hopefully you can see the family tree on your paper copies. There's over 100 companies working with Alaska LNG, and all the ones coded in green are Alaskan companies. So it's about two-thirds of the companies are Alaskan companies working with us. The point I would make about that slide isn't so much who's working with us. It's the fact that it's grown so much. If I know you might not remember, but if you think of the first update we had a family tree just like this, and there were 30 companies on it. So if you go back a year, that's what we're seeing in terms of engagement and growth. And you know, you can take a look at that at your leisure, but the photographs show what the work here that's getting done that we need to gather the data for the resource reports and geotechnical work and engage. That's Mike Ahart, our execution manager, talking about how different ways to build things. So that's the kind of work they're doing there. And the reason they're doing it is to inform what we call the resource reports. In the center of the page, you can see everything that's required to file the FERC application. A through D is about the different corporate structures and the information that how do you get that permit. E is about how do you do it safely. And F is what are you doing. And that's what's called resource reports. And the subset of those resource reports is detailed on the left side of the page with those 13 titles. And what we have is for every element of the project, we have to talk about all those 13 things and develop a report. Now, in the public domain are the first draft resource reports that were submitted in the first quarter of 2015. We'll be submitting the second draft of the resource reports. We like to characterize them as the first draft was written in pencil, the second draft is written in pen. Both are subject to comment, and then they both inform the application. But everything you need to know about those different characteristics is captured in those 13 resource reports, and those will be going in between February and May of 2016. And to get a fourth quarter 2016 application if all those other pieces can fall into place. As I said, you know, the 2015 field season went really well. We learned a lot, and the crews just did an outstanding job. So I really appreciate everything they did, and you know, like to take any chance, because I know a few of them are out there listening to me say that, you know, you guys did a great job. So finally, I just wanted to wrap up with kind of where we're going and talk a little bit about how all the project knits together. Some of you may recognize this as the gated process, but all I put here is just the gated process from a project perspective. The first thing we do is define the concept. Where are all the pieces of the project, the plant, the line? How does that all work? That's what we spent $107 million on. That green box for Alaska LNG cost $107 million. We did it between 2012 and the middle of 2014. So in 2.5 years, we spent $107 million on that green box. The blue box is where, the light blue box is where we are now. And that's what we've spent $376 million on. That's to get the design right, make sure the concept works, make sure that we have the cost and schedule information for FEED, make sure that the regulatory work is on track. That then sets up the big question that the owners need information on, is do you move from the light blue box to the dark blue box, which is called FEED? And in FEED, you'd get very detailed regulatory reports, because even though the first draft resource reports were 10,000 pages and the next draft is probably going to be 5 to 6 times that, that's just the starting price to get all this regulatory work done. That is just spinning up the regulatory machine. It's much more expensive, and there's a lot more work that has to get done there. And then you advance all the project definition. You translate from what we call process flow diagrams, which are simple analysis of how everything works, to very detailed P&IDs, which are very detailed, how does all the pipe look, where's the wiring, what is the size of every bolt and every nut, how does that all work, and a capital cost estimate that is absolutely very, very, very robust. It's very certain. And then that allows you to go into an execution phase with the gap between FEED and startup being what's called FID, or the final investment decision, where you ask yourself, do I want to spend that money? So if you step away from that, you'd say, I spent about $30 million a year in concept. I'm spending $30 million a month in pre-FEED. Do I have enough certainty and confidence that I want to spend $30 million a week in FEED, so that I can consider FID to spend $30 million a day? And that's how that curve looks. And that's why you see those shapes in the next one. You have spending growing asymptotically as your ability to change things goes way, way down. So that's why we do things here in design. You want to get things right now when you have spend rates that are relatively low. Even though we're spending $30 million a month, it's relatively low compared to execution, where it's $30 million a day. So you want to get everything right today. And with that philosophy, our forward plans are to finish the pipeline sizing, get that done in April, identify the interconnection points with AGDC, make sure we really understand exactly what everyone's thinking so that the hydraulic model can be finished, all the reliability, availability, maintainability modeling can be finished so that we know everything in the system, and then we can really think about what does that machine look like and where can I get it and who might even source it. So how do I buy that then? What's that contracting strategy so I get the machine at the lowest possible cost? Complete the pre-FEED deliverables, cost schedule analysis, design of everything, continue the cost optimization work, which we highlighted on each page, where we're really trying hard to cut costs. We're targeting $6 to $10 billion of cost reduction. I don't know if we'll get it all, but we're stretching for that. My favorite slides, favorite phrase on this whole presentation is lowest cost of supply wins. That's what this is all about. And then consistent with that, we want to keep the FERC process going, because it's critical path, and once you get the resource reports de-risked, you can make a lot of other decisions, because we don't know how long it's going to take to get an EI, environmental impact statement, or an authorization to construct. So your phasing on how much money you spend before you know that is important, because there's been a lot of projects where people thought, oh, they'll certainly get a permit, and they've put up a whole bunch of money and then not gotten a permit. So as the board of directors for the owners, I want to share information with you that we try very hard to make sure we phase our spending consistent with this model, so that as our risks go down, our resources go up, and we all have confidence to move through the different phases. So that's kind of where we'll be moving over the 2016 period.
Very good, Steve. Thank you for that great overview. It really sets the stage for the rest of the meetings this week. We're going to be continuing to pursue this update. In fact, we'll be meeting again. Our next hearing is Wednesday, January 27th, and we're going to be hearing from the AKLNG fiscal team. So a lot of the questions we asked today were fiscally related, so that'll be the team to ask those too. Senator Stoltz.
Yeah, and thank you, Madam Chair. I wasn't anticipating anything, Gordon. I know Mr. Butt is a project manager, but sometimes you spit out your questions that my constituents are most concerned about. I understand the state may not even shared all the results of the fiscal consultancy work. The partners may not even be aware of that, and those are really some of this. As Mr. Butt communicated to somebody who wasn't in this room, I think I may have been. Just at least obliquely communicating to people that might not be in this room but might be listening, and trying to frame those questions. And as we're talking with the team, there was a lot of discussion about labor, training, workforce preparedness. As we're in a whole different fiscal regime, again, it's not Mr. Butt's wheelhouse here, but the administration is listening. I'd sure like to hear some discussion about how we might reevaluate how we deploy very scarce resources There's a lot of private sector folks that certainly are more nimble, more cost conscious than a state agency, and have a lot better responsiveness just because of just the nature of being a non-government entity. It's just reality. UPS treats you and FedEx treats you a lot better than the post office does, with all due respect to my post office friends, because you have to go there. And you know, and they certainly have quantifiable results and effectiveness. And that's just one piece of this. I'm looking forward to, really, I think there's a lot of things that were deferred to the state team, and whatever their attorney-client privilege allows them to divulge, I'm anxious to hear.
Very good. Well, the time is 5 p.m., and so we'll go ahead and adjourn today, but we'll continue the discussion on Wednesday. So I'll see you all on Wednesday. The meeting is adjourned. Let the record reflect. It is 5 p.m.